All right. Today is October 20th. This is lecture number 15. Is it October 26th? 22nd. Sorry about that. I'm on Southeast Asian time. No. This is October 22nd. For those of you who want to set your watches. And this is lecture 15. I think that is correct, isn't that? Yes. Titled Strategic Nature of the Vietnam War, Part 1. It deals with the strategy and the tactics employed and with the general overall strategic thinking of the participants, North Vietnamese, the Viet Cong, and Part 2 next Tuesday, South Vietnamese, the Americans, and the other Allied forces. You should have before you four handouts. One, a kind of lecture outline. Two, balance of forces, dated 1972, comparing North and South Vietnam strengths. The strategic debate, which is the heart of this talk, really, in Hanoi, a couple of charts. And probably the most important, the schematic of Vietnamese Communist Revolutionary War. That's something you should study. I'll be talking about it, and you can use what I say to try to interpret it. This business of strategy and tactics is a subject that I've written a great deal about, several books. I also have a great deal of research material available if any of you are interested to pursue it further. Any of you are military or ROTC, or you want it for a term paper, see me at the center. Text of my sermon should be that the Vietnam War was unique, singular, unlike any war before it, and probably is the face of future war. As a journalist friend of mine observed at the time, Vietnam is a war for people with double vision, fought against a two-faced enemy using two kinds of combat, one open and orthodox, and the other clandestine with few rules. The intelligence community in Saigon was charged during the war with providing the two standard military intelligence estimates, enemy capability and enemy intention. The nature of the war made it impossible for anything like a precise, scientifically determined, statistically vetted estimate either of the enemy's prowess or battle plans. The best the community could offer was educated, often shrewd guesses by experienced analysts who were hardened in the fires of repeated failure. As was sardonically observed by the working level spooks at the time, anyone around here who is not thoroughly confused simply doesn't know what's going on. The essential reason for this was twofold. First, because of the socio-political influences on the ground there in Indochina. This was a product of history and heritage, which we've examined earlier, which could cause a cultural context to the war. Second, the strategy employed by the other side. Thus, it was a condition of both inadvertent and deliberate, but unintentional and done with malice aforethought, as the lawyers would say. Leaders in Hanoi, both generals and in the high command and the civilians in the Politburo, viewed the Vietnam War from start to finish, through a very special prism of strategy and dogma. These colored and shaped, some would say distorted, their view of their own and of their enemies' day-to-day actions, as well as their perceptions of the grand sweep of the struggle. Their viewpoint must be grasped with some empathy, else it is impossible to understand the fundamental concept of what the war was all about, or even to make sense out of the way they pursued battle. Communist leaders' search for a grand strategy, which we here term Dao Chan, or struggle, began at least as far back as the 1930s and was pursued seriously and relentlessly throughout the entire period subsequent, Viet Minh War, World War II, Viet Minh War, and the subsequent Vietnam War. It was an endeavor which the American leadership pursue this sort of systematic strategic thinking, never felt necessary to emulate. Which is probably why the war turned out the way it did. What emerged in Hanoi was a fully developed, highly complex, fully articulated, totally modern strategic concept. Although it is jam-packed with special Vietnamese terminology, it was universal in that it flowed with the historical trend of the time, and it harnessed for its own use the great social forces that were loose throughout the world in the last half of the 20th century. Conceptually, it was so broad that it virtually spanned the entire spectrum of human activity, military, political, social, psychological. The Dao Chan strategy metaphor employed by cadres in Pavan and in the Viet Cong basic training camp is a set of ice tongs. The two sharply pointed, I don't think I have a schematic on that. Maybe you do. Yeah, this is. This you all have, right? At the training camps and basic training camps, both in North and South Vietnam, the cadres that were indoctrinating and training these troops used this concept here, this basic concept in which Dao Chan is of two types, armed Dao Chan, political Dao Chan. The enemy is there in the middle. And the metaphor they used was that this is like ice tongs. You cannot pick up a block of ice with one tong. You must use two tongs. One of these armed tongs or arms was armed Dao Chan, which means various kinds of violence, not only guerrilla and regular force warfare, but other kinds of military attacks, but kidnappings, assassination, and what the other side called terrorism. The other arm is called political Dao Chan, and this does not mean politics in the Western sense of the word. At best, it means politics with guns. That is specifically a set of van, V-A-N, or this. They are on here. The three van are action programs. Van meaning action, which seeks to organize, mobilize, and motivate, or compel, where necessary, support for the cause. These two arms or elements are distinct from each other, but cannot be employed separately. No more than, as I say, you can lift an ice block of ice with one tongue. Only in combination, that is, in the marriage of social organization to violence, can the strategy succeed. The genius of this is to be found in this dualism. The theory of the strategy is relatively neat and clear-cut, but it's not at all neat or clear-cut in its application. In Hanoi, throughout the war, interpretation of the doctrine continually rent the poet role. The central quarrel was over the proper relationship or the balance between these two forms of Dao Chan, political and armed. It was not really an abstract argument, because it really cut to the quick in crucial matters such as allocation of resources, particularly manpower. Two forms of Dao Chan, it was agreed, were, another metaphor, hammer and anvil. But the wartime history of the poet war can be written entirely in terms of the doctrinal dispute over this, which was the hammer and which was the anvil. The question was posed was quite simple. How do we win in the South? Winning being defined as unification of North and South Vietnam under Hanoi banner. Agreement on what? Yes. But no agreement on how. The two main figures in this, and I'd say probably as an aside, it's too bad we didn't have such a debate in our own camp about how to win. And it's too bad it didn't get as hot and as vociferous as it did in Hanoi, because it was a kind of purifying mechanism for clearing out thoughts. It follows that the strategy to be defeated, both pincer arms must be blunted. Late in the war, Arvin, Americans, and the other military forces did actually defeat armed Dao Chan. The American Army, as you have heard, for instance, won every major battle it fought, which is a record virtually unparalleled in the history of warfare. But the GVN and the U.S. were unable to deal successfully with the second arm, the political Dao Chan. And this was not so much a challenge of achieving victory as of solving a problem. And in the failure of that, I'll come back to this, lay the seeds of defeat. The handout you have is another handout that points out the debaters as the war progressed. You can study that at your leisure. What I'd like to do chiefly in this lecture is to explain this basic concept of Dao Chan. There are 6 points, really, to make on it. Unfortunately, I only have 3 with me. All right, well, there are 3 points to be made. The strategy combines Marxist, Leninist, and Maoist doctrines on warfare and is chiefly characterized by the breadth of definition. It includes elements and activities not normally associated with armed forces or with war making. 2, violence is employed and is defined as revolutionary violence to distinguish it from other forms of force in warfare. There are 2 kinds of revolutionary force, military and political. Sometimes diplomatic force may be regarded as a 3rd force, or be considered as part of the political force. These 2 forms always operate simultaneously and in coordinated fashion. 3, military force manifests itself as military actions, but can include institutional activities such as kidnappings, assassinations, you don't usually think of as belonging to an army. Strategy implied is guerrilla and guerrilla type, using the traditional 3 kinds of troops: regional, territorial, regular, regional, and local. That is, they employ separate kinds of tactics, each of them, which are determined by terrain, which in Vietnam was traditionally divided into 3 types: upland, jungle, the delta of rural lowland, and the city. Tenets of what's taught in the military academy in North Vietnam, even today, is, and this is one of the 6 points. First 3 were not 6 points. This is the 6 points. And this is what military academies in North Vietnam and throughout Vietnam now give as a standard basic education. First, Dao Chan means there must be total mobilization of the people, quote, organizing millions to rush into battle. This is a task which only the party is capable of handling. 2, the struggle must be geared to the broader world scene and to the direction that history is taking the world. Harness the party's strength to the strength of the era and to the strength of international development. This is their slogan. Implicit in this instruction is a sense that there is a need for outside support, psychic as well as material. 3, the force of nationalism must be linked to the appeal of socialism and communism. 4, an aggressive mentality is required for all participants. It must be manifested by continuing offensive action, even if it's insignificant. The great enemy here is passivity. 5, the struggle, as they say in the theater, must build. Strategy should seek to deliver small defeats to the enemy, one after another, so that he is slowly reduced until the final coup de grace can be delivered. The struggle must come in stages. And 6, the most important requirement is the proper blending and the timing of armed struggle and political struggle, which seems, as it is taught there in the final resolve, to be a kind of matter of intuitive judgment by the leader. Time here is the mystic dimension. The Vietnamese, we've seen, have a kind of mystic feeling about time. Khoi Cho, the proper moment when you do something or when you don't do something. It's just a sense. Almost all Vietnamese believe this, but they can't really explain how it works. All right, the great debate that went on in Hanoi, 1959 at the start, clear through to the end, 72. The first type of debate, the first level of activity, as you can see from the chart, was the revolutionary guerrilla war strategy. This is 1959 to 1965. Here the rule was adopt, or the strategy was to adopt Maoist and Viet Minh war strategy and tactics to the new situation that was faced in the South. Use Dao Chan's strategy of armed and political struggle. Weaken the GVN, force it to accept terms, our terms, Northern terms, for unification. use the NLF or the Front Organization and the Third Force elements were to our advantage. The debate over this at that time in Hanoi was over the allocation of resources, how much you put into armed struggle, how much into political struggle, how many cadres do you assign to each of them. The great debate here at the Politburo level was between General Jap and a main party theoretician, Trung Chin. They argued this all through the war, each one of them at the Politburo level arguing for a change of strategy, and they did change strategy back and forth when one side was able to persuade the Politburo that it was necessary to make a change of strategy. The first major change came, really, when the Revolutionary Guerrilla War was not working, it wasn't delivering unification, and now in late 1964, early 65, there was a prospect that the Americans were coming in strength. So that called for a new strategy, and it meant abandonment pretty much of Trung Chin's Revolutionary Guerrilla War strategy in favor of General Jap's what was called regular force strategy. His argument was, and that group was, that we can win quick victory by launching an ever greater momentum of attacks which are militarily and psychologically devastating to the enemy. The counter-argument by this, by the Trung Chin people, was in a toe-to-toe slugging match with the enemy, because of his firepower, he will decimate our strength. We simply cannot match him in mass and movement. That was, I guess, argued, and nevertheless, the regular force strategy was became the operative one from about 1964 to the Tet Offensive of 1968. And the argument there in holding and staging this great offensive was we can outlast and out-endure the enemy, but we cannot do it by slugging it out toe-to-toe. We must never give him an opportunity to bring to bear his vaunted advantage in mass and movement. That was the doctrine that was adopted after the Tet Offensive in 68, which was quite clearly, despite what has been written, a failure, and so regarded as a failure in Hanoi. It was a kind of ironic thing in which Jap had argued, we make this massive attack, Trung Chin said it will not work, and then afterwards, I think Trung Chin had to say, well, you do have a point, General. Your strategy did bring down the President of the United States. But that's my very point. That is the way you win. You were winning off the battlefield. Not, you didn't intend to do this, so you don't really get any credit for it. Anyway, the period after 1964, sometimes called the super guerrilla strategy, was the argument that we can outlast and out-endure the enemy, but never give him anything to hit us. Don't allow him to use the obvious advantage he has in terms of massive firepower and movement, particularly the ubiquitous helicopter. Argument against this, and General Jap's argument, in effect, was this is a no-win policy. It's designed to permit our forces to survive and to continue to exist, but it's too defensive. It dooms us never to go through the gates of victory. Slow down a typhoon and it breaks up. This obtained until it didn't work, and General Jap, I think, came back into the conference room with his new set of blueprints, saying, I have a plan here to win the war with one last hurrah. This was the Easter Offensive of 1972. I'll go back to these battles later on. I'm just trying to lay out here the zigzagging of the debate that went on in Hanoi during this time. Well, the Easter Offensive didn't work either, so Trung Chin came back into the room with his... Well, the belief is that Trung Chin and his people in the Politburo agreed to endorse, because collective judgment, collective leadership rule, when Jap said that, well, this is going to break their back, the 72 Offensive, Easter, so-called Easter Offensive, that the Trung Chin forces said, all right, we'll vote for it and go along with it, but if it doesn't, and we don't think it will, but if it doesn't, then you have got to agree that we will go back to our new form of strategy, which was the so-called negotiated settlement strategy. Well, when the Easter offensive did not work, then Trung Chin brought in his marker, and that became the strategy. The argument was, we can't drive the Americans out militarily, but we can negotiate them out. And once they're out, they won't come back. And once they're out, whatever else, our prospects will be brighter than they are now. And the argument against this was a sort of standard one that you cannot win at the conference table what you're unable to win on the battlefield. And there's no reason for we, for the North, for Baltimore, to assume that the conditions imposed by the Americans for a political settlement won't be disadvantageous to us, if not disastrous. I guess the point to underline on this is that that the whole war in Hanoi was, at the highest level, was a search for a formula for victory. They tried one thing after another. It didn't work. They tried the opposite. They went back and forth, back and forth. The image that they knew what they were doing, in one sense, simply doesn't hold up. But they knew what they wanted to do, but they didn't know how to do it. And the irony, as we'll see later, was that even when the war was all over, they were still trying to figure out how it is that they won. Anyway, the doctrine, one point, is that, that outsiders who weren't watching this very closely thought that there was no problem in Hanoi. They knew what they were doing, knew how they were doing it, no arguments or anything. This was not the case at all. We actually don't know a great deal about this yet, but I think we will come to know about it more. The second significance of this doctrinal dispute and the history of this strategy and search for strategy by the North Vietnamese has to do with the significance of doctrine in warfare. The ideological or psychological dimension of warfare, when reduced to its most elemental level, consists of two basic thematic assertions. One, certainty of victory. Two, monopolization of virtue. Certainty of victory, monopolization of virtue. Each side in every war in history has employed intensively or half-heartedly, with or without success, these two themes. Victory is certain for the just side, or the righteous side, or deserving side, or God's side, Allah's side. And we, on our side, monopolize virtue. We are the good guys, they're the bad guys. The enemy epitomizes villainy. It's a very sharp, clear-cut mirror image. Until the Vietnam War, this ideological dimension was considered at best a kind of adjunct to the acts of warfare. But something of a common agreement existed among earlier warring powers that the battle would be the payoff, that victory would be decided in the field. The Vietnamese communist strategy with this strategist, with this concept, broke with that doctrine that the chief and primary test of warfare must be on the battlefield. They realized dimly at first and with increasing clarity that it might be possible to move the entire venue of the war off the battlefield and to cause the decisive test to take place away from the battlefield. Set new rules of engagement to establish new criteria for defining victory. With the Dao Chan strategy, great pressure would be generated. The GVN would disintegrate, leaving the Americans faced with a condition in which the necessary countermeasures would be so draconian, so costly, that they would choose to withdraw and to be defeated without ever having been engaged. The true genius of this doctrine is not simply that it updated the ancient axiom of divide and conquer, although it did do that, divide the Americans from the South Vietnamese, for example, but the real genius is it employed the judo principle. It used the weight of the enemy's philosophic system against the enemy himself. So as such, it works best against a democracy of decent people and least well against fanatics or barbarians. It is asserted and agreed on all sides that justice here must triumph. Eventually, that victory will go to the just. But this does not stigmatize the enemy as unjust in toto. Rather, the enemy, that is, the Americans particularly, was an abstraction. South Vietnamese enemy was an abstraction. It was an unjust group, perhaps, some crooked landlords and vicious landlords and crooked generals, a few others who were misled. But the enemy was not painted as evil with a brush that tired out. Hence, the more or less normal wartime psychological polarization was denied. Sympathy for the enemy's cause was permissible. Even fraternization was not treason. That's why 50,000 Americans in Vietnam, Saigon, during the war, could wander anywhere, day or night, any down, any alley, with complete impunity. They had no, they didn't realize this fully, but some of us did, but there were no danger from the Viet Cong. You could have killed lots of them, but that would have destroyed the purpose of this image that they were creating. And again, it was asserted to the opposite camp, particularly to the Americans, not only in Vietnam, but in America. We are not your enemy. The enemy is only the unjust person who wishes to pursue an unjust war. And surely you're not one of these, are you? So that image was a broad canvas, which we called the test of virtue. On the one side was this idealized sketch painted by Hanoi, an exclusive view, since all objective inspection of the communist camp was denied. And on the other side was a portrait of their enemy, as drawn by the Vietnamese, North Vietnamese and Viet Cong, and the press and everyone else, starkly depicting all the errors, the shortcomings, and the follies. The American viewer, although it's in the United States, recognizing that this communist side was idealized, could not fully confirm the picture of his own, the very human side, because seldom does a reality compare with the artist's conception. Now, countering this effort was difficult, as we will see next week. It was also poorly done. The essential GVN failure, however, was due to deficiency in technique and not in some latent desire. The general sentiment to confront and oppose the VC in the North Vietnamese was real and present and ever present and widespread. It's probably a truism that what was required was a thought-out counter-Dao Chan strategy that addressed Dao Chan itself, rather than the German approach of the Americans particularly was that we were going to fight this war under our ground rules, and we didn't really need to know what the other rules were. And the irony is that we wound up fighting the war under their rules, and we didn't even know what the rules were. But there was, nevertheless, I want to stress that the notion that there was an authentic and a mass-based opposition to the Viet Cong and to the North Vietnamese in South Vietnam. It was not simply a clique of generals and landlords in the capital who were attempting to maintain power. Throughout the war, there existed a genuine and a sizable non-communist, or nationalist, if you will, as they preferred to describe themselves, a non-communist nationalist force which was more than an extension of the chief of state, of Ngo Dinh Diem or the generals, whoever he might be at the moment. Anti-GVN sentiment, especially when it escalated, was often erroneously equated, like the riots and demonstrations, was often equated by outsiders with being pro-communist sentiment. But the Vietnamese in the South throughout the war demonstrated a manifest ability to be at the same time anti-communist, anti-GVN, anti-NLF, anti-VC, anti-foreign, you name it, they were against them all. As a strategy, Dao Chan was, I think history would judge, a superb concept. It outflanked modern weaponry. It was fully in tune with the temper of the time, the last half of the 20th century. It successfully harnessed social forces already loosened by others. It appeared to further rather than to exploit the cause that it espoused. It manipulated through self-manipulation, the sort of do-it-yourself revolution. That's another fairly complicated subject of how you get villagers to revolt. It will be a subject of future lecture. You have the added benefit, I would say, of, since it was cast in terms of the people, of making opposition to it appear as anti-egalitarian. While those on both sides directly involved understood the proxy nature of this strategy, the people as servo mechanism, outsiders generally remain confused as to who was fighting whom and why, a confusion of major utility to the other side. As a chief offensive device of the NLF and the North Vietnamese, it accomplished all that could have been expected of it. That it did not deliver victory in itself does not deny its validity. Blame or credit for this rests elsewhere. Now, in judging Dao Chan's strategy, certain caveats must be noted. We're too close to this phenomenon, I would say, to see it fully and clearly. Conclusions must be tentative. The strategy is part of a worldwide geopolitical dynamic in which the entire concept of war is being reevaluated, and nobody knows the extent that this impact is going to have on history's judgment. However, certain constants remain. Enlightened leadership, technological skill, disciplined organization, foolproof logistical systems, military unit pride, individual spirit and courage, high morale, these are factors that have not changed and are not necessarily subjected to the wiles of Dao Chan strategy. All right, three conclusions on Dao Chan strategy. The first is that the strategy put warfare into a new conceptual framework. Its essence is the idea of people as the chief instruments of war. Not people as combatants or people providing support, but people as weapons to be designed, formed, forged, and hurled into battle. All people, without exception, are to be regarded as such weapons of war and are as expendable as any weapon is. A youth under 10 is some ways better weapon than an adult soldier. So children are not excluded, particularly children are not excluded. Purpose of political Dao Chan is to mobilize the people. The purpose of these three Van programs, Dick Van, Bin Van, and Zan Van, which I'll say a little bit in a minute, that the three Van programs create the hammer on which that will smash the enemy on the anvil of armed Dao Chan. The secret of success, since the enemy obviously can emulate technique, is superior organization, which requires and permits fuller mobilization. What is launched then, in fact, is a war of competing organizational weapons. And the best rule for this became that the victory will go to the side that becomes the best organized, stays the best organized, and can most successfully disorganize his opponent. Now, structuring the struggle in this manner channels the enemy's response. It, in effect, dictates his strategy. He is forced to fight under unfavorable terms. Americans and the South Vietnamese would have preferred to fight a war of professional technology, out and away from the population center, in outer space, if possible. And the kind of war that was Vietnam, closing with the enemy, battling him in his own arena, of and across the people. Here was a war different not in degree of violence or misery or death, but in kind. The devastation formerly directed at a target or confined to a battlefield now is visited on the people themselves. They were the battlefield. Countering that strategy required population and resources control, which meant invariably and deliberately inflicting civilian punishment, if not casualty. Now, this was seen by outsiders as brutal acts against non-combatants. But those on the inside, those who were there, came to understand the nature of the war and to know that no other strategic response was possible. Second conclusion, that Dao Chan strategy can confound the enemy's strategic response by creating what might be called a crisis of perception, and the enemy can. That's an important concept, this crisis of perception that was generated both in South Vietnam and in the United States. If you create this kind of crisis of perception, you channel the enemy's perception of the world. The operational role here is that military force must never be seen as naked, must always be politically clothed. Every action must appear to be political, perhaps with some military overtones. Or if this is not possible in a major military attack, it must be made to appear defensive violence with a political purpose, never simply military action for its own sake. Now this exploits the average civilian's view of war and politics. War is regarded as wrong and evil, even if sometimes necessary. But politics are human nature in action, always and everywhere acceptable. Thus, if violence or military action can be defined politically and is so perceived, it is much more palatable. Neither Pavin's strategy nor his conduct of war was widely understood by either Vietnamese or Americans, mainly because it never seemed necessary. Failure to perceive this, in part, is put down to the effectiveness, I would argue, of the Dao Chan strategy, and in skill, in Hanoi skill, in obfuscating and distorting the nature of the war. Thus, certainly as much blame must rest on those doing the perceiving, in Saigon and even more so in Washington. Their leaders, especially in the earlier years, seem to suffer what Aldous Huxley has called invincible ignorance. Invincible ignorance is something that you do not know, you know you don't need it, and you don't know it, but you don't think you need to know it. Newton, I guess, was believed the last man who knew everything. So everyone since Newton does not know everything and cannot know everything, so you make these judgments as to what you need to know and what you don't. At Berkeley, when I was teaching in a classroom that was about 20 feet off the sea level, right on the coast, I used the example of the hole in the ozone in the Arctic ice mass. And according to some calculations, if the hole in the ozone gets bigger and this ice mass melts, the Pacific Ocean will go up 50 feet. And here we are sitting 30 feet from sea level, so that will mean 20 feet over our head. So when we're going down for the last time, we will say to ourselves, now there's an example of invincible ignorance. Something you didn't know, you knew you didn't know it, but you didn't think it made any difference. Well, most things don't make them, sometimes they do. This is the case where it did. So we proceeded, the Americans particularly, in their conduct of war without ever making a serious effort to direct the, understand the strategy directed against them, hardly even examined their enemy. Pentagon Papers are a classic documentary evidence of this. 14 volumes. They shipped them to me in Vietnam, and I put them beside my bed, and I was going through them night after night. I had a yellow tab. I was taking notes as to, I was writing about North Vietnam strategy at the time. What does the Pentagon Papers say about North Vietnam strategy? At the end of about 3 weeks, I'd gone through the whole pile, and I had half a page of notes out of the whole zillion pages. And what I did have was worthless. I had was Robert McNamara, in effect, saying, well, what are the North Vietnamese up to? Well, what we must do, I must do, I, Robert McNamara, is put myself in the position of Ho Chi Minh and ask, what would I do if I were Ho Chi Minh? And so we're going to bomb the North Vietnamese, and if I'm Ho Chi Minh, I don't want to be bombed, so I will do those things that will stop the bombing, which was perfectly good logic, except Ho Chi Minh wasn't reasoning that way. We didn't do this in other wars. It's something of a puzzle to me why. We made a very serious effort in trying to determine the thinking, the mindset, the psychology of the Germans. In London, for example, during World War II, there was a group of necromancers and fortune tellers and stargazers who met every day and cast Hitler's horoscope, because we knew that Hitler's necromancers were doing this. And so there was some hope maybe you can get some kind of idea on what he's going to do. And there was some correlation. Bombing patterns often could be predicted on the basis of this. Not often, but anyway, the point is the effort was made, even a remote effort. Ruth Benedict was doing the same thing, Chrysanthemum and the Sed, trying to get inside the skull of the Japanese militarists. A magnificent work. Didn't prove entirely right, but the point is that effort was made. And we never made this effort. And I could never understand why. Years later, when I was assigned to the Pentagon as a State Department representative and had call on anything I wanted, I called for all of the documentation that they had in their files on what the North Vietnamese were up to. And the guy that came back said, we really can't find anything. There's a few reports there. There's an Indian ambassador talked to us in Washington, and there's a memorandum of conversation, but he's not a military. He didn't care much about the war, and so it remains something of a puzzle, this invincible ignorance notion. We haven't made that mistake since, I think, in the various mini wars that we've had. Made a big effort in the Gulf War, I think, to try to get into the skull of Saddam Hussein. That was, we couldn't get in with a bullet. Anyway, and this is evident from all the biographies and autobiographies that have come out of the principal figures of the Vietnam War since the war. It's evident that particularly in the White House, they lived in a kind of self-contained world, living very confidently in decision-making and ignoring the opposite camp. When you're not reminded of Aldous Huxley's definition of invincible ignorance, you're reminded of Goethe's observation, nothing is more frightening than ignorance in action. So for the average American attempting to follow the war, it was a case of sand in his eyes from the Dick Vaughan program, which so many well-meaning persons unwittingly contributed. The net effect was confusion. Most people, after a while, simply did not know what to make of the war. This was the crisis of perception. It was engendered by linguistically challenging thought through simple, systematic, semantic manipulation. Well, let me say at the bottom here, this political doctrine explains these three Bahn or action programs. Political force under this concept should be thought of as struggle of the people, particularly the villagers, struggling in terms of uprisings and other forms of organized protest, dissidents, riot, whatever you will. And these mechanisms had these activities involved these three specific mechanisms. Dick meaning enemy, Bahn meaning action. These are action among the enemy. That means the civilians in government areas, in the cities and in the villages that the government controlled. It was about 85% of all the Vietnamese across the country were villagers, so this was the main arena. Some of these were controlled by the GVN, most of them were controlled at varying times in the course of the war, and the rest were controlled under the Dân Bản, Action Among the People program, meaning people controlled by the communists, the Viet Cong, in what were called liberated villages. Dick Vaughan, Action Among the Enemy, it's important to understand, is non-military action against Arvin and against the Americans. That is, it's essentially proselytizing action against the Vietnamese military and civil servants to induce desertion or defection, or at least to reduce their effectiveness to commitment. This was well illustrated in the assassination program, which was aimed at village leaders and district leaders and in some cases provincial leaders. And the rule, quite clearly it became evident, was the people we go after to assassinate are the very best and the very worst. If you've got a really corrupt local official, go in, grab him, have a public trial, and execute him. If he's a very effective leader, go in and have a trial and a kangaroo court and come up with a bunch of charges against him. We found that he's been smuggling information, whatever it is, whatever will wash, and then you execute him. But the psychological effect of this is if you're a leader, particularly in a rather shaky village, you know that if you're very bad, they may come after you, and if you know that you're very good, they may come after you. So this puts great premium on mediocrity. You're good enough so that Saigon doesn't fire you, but you're not bad enough so that the DC come in and are good enough to kill you. It's very hard for a central government to deal with something. You don't think this guy out there is doing a very good job, but you don't know why. Maybe you don't understand his problems. Simply relieving him, if this is the case, doesn't help, because the next guy who goes in, we're going to be facing the same problem. It's a very pernicious. The action against the military, as I say, armed Dao Chan went after Arvin. That was an armed part of it. The political Dao Chan against the Arvin. Actually, this was originally known as Bin Van Chin Van, or B and C program. Chin meaning civil service. So it's a campaign against the military and against the civilian, non-military activity. What you try to do is to really, well, at best you hope to get desertion or defection, get the guy to come over to your side. But if you can't do that, what you try to do is programs that delimit his effectiveness. Extraordinary number of innovative devices that were used, a few typical ones. I was out of the Arvin camp one day, and there was a demonstration of women from the village nearby who were out in front demonstrating for and demanding higher pay for enlisted men in Arvin and for better treatment of their dependents. And the military colonel that was in charge said, that's a VC demonstration. I said, really? They're demonstrating something that you just got done telling me you needed. Yeah, I know. They're just using that. And when they get back to the village, then they will have a big meeting, and obviously it's not going to have any effect on me. I can't raise their salary. But when they go back to the village, they will have an after-struggle meeting, and the cadre will say, you see what you can do here with this technique? We got the attention. He came out and he talked to us, told us he couldn't give you a raise, but at least you had his attention. This has never happened before. Isn't this teach you something? In the book Vipayana, I've got hundreds of illustrative examples of these devices and techniques they would use for, you know, a young recruit. Ivan comes back from basic training to his village, and in the village he's met by this old woman who berates him for joining the VC, that he should be on the side of the people. And, you know, he's 16 years old and he thinks he's doing the right thing, and here's old Mrs. Bob that he's known all his life, and suddenly she's telling him what an evil person he is. Mrs. Bob is a VC cadre. It's very hard to, it was hard to us then, we knew these things were going on, very hard to evaluate how effective they were. I mean, did they have any real meaning or not? It couldn't help but have some effect. But anyway, the whole concept is the almost everything that the Viet Cong did, South Vietnamese did, through the whole war, can be put in one of these three boxes. And that, with the armed struggle, is what they thought would win victory. I think one final point is that Dao Chan's strategy succeeds to the extent, and only to the extent, that it can nullify or shut out the enemy's strength, both military and socio-political or psychic strength. In the Vietnam War, it was able to limit South Vietnamese counter-strategy, their actions in the village in some cases, and clearly it forced limitations on American conduct and caused hesitations in American pursuit of the war. The Allied forces in Vietnam had clear advantage in warfare.